This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, the Morro Bay Bird Festival.
Some are casual birders and some are diehard birders. They'll get a report saying there's a rare bird 200 miles away. They'll jump in their car.
Also on Playing with Food, we'll take a look at local coffee.
The nicest coffees in the world are in those tropical regions, but up high in the mountains where it's cooler. What they're trying to do with elevation, we're doing with latitude.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 28th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a conversation about road safety.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I have a guest today from SLOCOG, the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, which connects our communities by allocating federal and state funds and planning for the future and facilitating the collaboration of all levels of government, interested parties, and residents toward a common goal. SLOCOG has a board made up of leaders like mayors and supervisors throughout San Luis Obispo County. And SLOCOG has a staff too, like my guest today, who is John DeNunzio. He is a transportation planner with SLOCOG. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And today you're here to talk mostly about the Regional Road Safety Action Plan. SLOCOG is looking at road safety issues and impacts in underserved communities and a whole lot more. Can you talk about the plan briefly? Just give us a nutshell about what it is and talk about the progress that SLOCOG is making.
Sure. So about a year ago, we received a federal USDOT grant through the Safe Streets for All program to help regions and communities like ours to prepare a regional safety action plan. And we had a proclamation last October at our board proclaiming a road to zero. The road to zero is it's very similar to like the city of SLO has, which is a Vision Zero policy. It's to achieve zero roadway fatalities and serious injuries by a set point in time. So in this case, by 2050. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that road collisions and crashes won't still occur, because they likely will, but the fatalities and the severe injury part of it is something we can do something about, and that eliminating those is the goal of the plan.
Okay. What are the actual techniques in design and implementation that could improve the safety of our roads?
We're using something called the Safe Systems Approach, and there's a wheel. And within the wheel, there are elements like having safer cars. So as cars get smarter, the safety in them improves, and that's one component. And then another component is safer speeds, so reducing speeds. Another component is the street itself, safer streets, so designing for things like separated bike lanes or roundabouts or flashing beacons or rumble strips, right? Even good, well-maintained asphalt with bright white lines, those are things that can be done to the street. But then there's also emergency response time. So how long does it take for services to get to you once a collision occurs, post-crash care. And then there's the human factor. The safe system approach is underpinned by that humans are going to make mistakes, but that if all of the different elements within the safe system approach are working, then if a collision does occur, it will not be severe, life-threatening, or fatal.
Okay. And do the data that you're looking at focus on traffic incidents with bikes or pedestrians or vehicle versus vehicle or all of the above?
Yeah. So we're looking at all the data that comes through from the various police departments, CHP, all goes into a state clearinghouse database. We see it usually about a year after an incident occurs. And we're analyzing that over a 10-year and a 5-year period. And we're, for our plan, we're really focused on the last 5 years. But, you know, traffic data is only one type of data that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. A key part of this plan is going out to the communities and going out to the residents of Slo County and asking them, where do you feel unsafe? Mm-hmm. Tell us what your experience is. Tell us the roads. Tell us how you feel vulnerable on the road, bike, ped, car, motorcycle, truck, however you're getting around on the roads. We want to hear from you. And so we've been, I suppose, for the last 6 months going out, setting up tables and booths and resources, and together with our rideshare program, communicating out the intent to collect this information and hearing back from people.
How are you getting this information from the public?
So there are two surveys. One is kind of a traditional looking survey online where, depending if you're driving a car, walking, or biking, it will route you to just a few questions. And then there's a chance to add narrative. But then there's also a feedback map. On the feedback map, you know, it's kind of like Google Maps where you can go and drop a pin. Mm-hmm. We've asked the public and are continuing to ask the public through the middle of November to continue to show us through this where you feel unsafe and do you feel unsafe walking here, biking here, driving a car here, or what?
So is that a survey that is ongoing and anybody can fill that out anytime? Is that something you want to share, how people might access that?
Yeah, I really do. And thanks for the opportunity. At slowcogroadtozero.org, there is a tab for getting involved. And within that, there are two surveys. We will be concluding that segment of our study probably after the World Day of Remembrance. We will then be and are already starting to assimilate the data between or aggregate the data between what we're seeing from CHP and the police departments, the crash data, and the public feedback together. And so with that, we'll have a better data picture. But then we're also hearing stories mm-hmm. and anecdotes. People are turning up and telling us about places in the community where they see cars are driving too fast, speeding in Santa Margarita or in Cambria, deer in Cambria, agricultural vehicles in south of Napomo, the 46 East, the Shalam, the Y, mm-hmm. Welsona Road. Unfortunately, our list of troubled spots is long. It's a long list, and we've had it for a long time.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, as I'm sure you've heard this one before, as somebody who travels back and forth between San Luis Obispo and Los Osos on Los Osos Valley Road, I get really nervous going out of the Laguna area and into the rural part of Los Osos Valley Road because people treat it kind of like a freeway on-ramp. Same thing coming from Los Osos into San Luis Obispo. When Los Osos Valley Road narrows to one lane, people are, you know, they're trying to get ahead of each other and like go really fast and pass each other last minute to get ahead. I just want to get one car ahead. And you're probably hearing those kinds of stories.
It reminds me of sort of a sad story, right? So on that section of road, there's a dedication to a young girl from the community of Los Osos, Samantha Hammerland. And although her fatality occurred on Highway 1 in the Chorro Valley, the dedication to her is on Los Osos Valley Road. I remember her, you know, from 15 years ago, and it was just one tragedy that affected everyone in her age group, everyone in her at her school. I mean, she was just a few years after high school.
I know that family.
So the story is not just about the data, and it's not just about telling you where you feel unsafe, but we're now at a phase of the plan. So we're about halfway through. Listening to the community now is taking the shape of trying to hear from the stories, and then November 17th, which is a Sunday, there's going to be something called the World Day of Remembrance. And this is going to be about an hour-long memorial held at the Slo County Courthouse. Mm-hmm. And it's a chance for families and individuals who may wish to come and participate in a community memorial for remembering road traffic victims. There'll be a program, we'll ring a bell, there'll be lighting candles and a few speeches. There's also an opportunity for individuals to sign up in advance should they like a few moments of time to speak during the service.
If somebody wants to do that, how do they sign up?
We have started a website. It's WDOR-SLO.org, World Day of Remembrance-SLO.org.
Okay, WDOR-SLO.org. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell with you on KCBX. My guest today is John DeNunzio, who's a transportation planner with SLOCOG, the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. And we're talking about the Regional Road Safety Action Plan for our area and the Road to Zero. So yes, there is a very human element to traffic safety. People get hurt. People die on our roads locally, people who we know. That must be a really sobering thing for you to think about and your colleagues to think about as you're working on this Road to Zero project.
Well, sure. So the team at SLOCOG and the consulting team, so we've been able through the federal grant to hire road safety experts from a reputable nationwide firm to help us to look at it. We do need to remember that there are lives and behind the data points. It's something that's challenging to do sometimes, but taking a program like this and out to the community, listening to them, hearing stories, meeting people, and really forming new partnerships. So for example, about 3 years ago, I hardly worked with anybody from CHP. As a planner, I write a lot of grants, state and federal grant writer. You'll get to the part in the grant where you have to talk about safety. So there's tools that we can go to where you pull down and can see, for example, the traffic statistics for Los Osos Valley Road. Mm-hmm. Take that information, put it in the grant, and then go about my business. Once this program started, I needed to go down to the SLO Farmers Market the night of, I think they have a public safety night every year at the SLO Farmers Market. It's when the police set up all the booths and you can see the cool cars like the CHP, the Dodge Viper, and then they've got the cool tanks. I had to go down there and basically meet the CHP officers. They are setting up their booths. I had to introduce myself to them. And I found that that partnership has been tremendous, how it's grown over the last 3 years. Additionally, County Public Health, the same thing. From my perspective in starting the project, it was a new relationship. So Public Health recently had their Slow Health Counts report come out just in the last couple months. And it turns out from their perspective, within the top three or four leading causes of death in Slow County for 15 to 44-year-olds is road injury. Hmm. And then likewise, when you go to the hospitals and you talk to the trauma units. And so, yes, some of this happened over COVID. We saw less people on the road, but people were driving faster. And so collisions were becoming more severe. We talked to the trauma units at the hospital, and they said, yeah, road injuries are within our top three. And they surpassed some of the other types of traumas that they had to deal with. And then the SLO EMSA.
And what does that stand for?
The SLO Emergency Medical Services Agency. So it's a division of County Public Works. Okay. So they aggregate data from the fire departments and the ambulance departments. They compile it and keep track of the incidences. They keep track of slightly different information than the CHP do.
So you're working with a lot of different entities and agencies throughout San Luis Obispo County to hit this road to zero and the goal to eventually eliminate and certainly drastically reduce fatalities and serious injuries on our roads locally. Do the data show that education and promotion reduce incidents?
Absolutely. The type of work that the Friday Night Live group does, where they go out to schools and educate. They do a mock situation where they say that one of the students has unexpectedly died in a car crash. And they simulate that at the various schools. And then they have in the gymnasium a meeting and they talk about the issues of what it's like to lose somebody at the school from roadway trauma. Programs like that, as well as just the simple messages of using a seatbelt, keeping people inside vehicles, wearing a helmet when you're riding a bike, those basic messages are still very valid statistically. For example, as cars are being engineered in a way that protects people inside, so the vehicle will be crumbled, but the passengers will be protected. But they're only protected if you've got a seatbelt on. So if you're sitting in the back and you don't have a seatbelt on, your chances of surviving are considerably, you know, reduced. And then likewise with helmets, you know, even skateboarding around, you know, Los Osos, going down Santa Isabel on some hill and having fun. If you're not wearing a helmet, you know, you crack your head, chances are it could be pretty bad for you. So, and even though I think culturally we've moved a long way with drunk driving, the statistics for our area, they're still about matched with what we see around the state. So for instance, impaired driving numbers are about the same for our area as they are statewide. But our collisions that occur at intersections are twice as bad as around the state.
Wow.
What does that say about our area? And then what kind of intersections are they? Where do they take place? Mm-hmm. Is it in a downtown urban area like Foothill and Highway 1, for example? Or are they rural at-grade crossings like Tassajara or like El Campo was, or even up at Vino Robles as mm-hmm. you're trying to pull out?
Do you know the answer to that? What type they are? Are they urban or rural?
Well, there's a mix, yeah, you know, okay. But these are the types of situations that then we'll look at as transportation planners, and we will combine the science and the anecdotes into information and compile something called a high injury network. And so a high injury network will tell us not just where things have occurred. That's a common misconception that because an accident has happened here or it's happened here twice, that will still be a place where an accident is going to occur. Civil engineers and professionals predict where the likelihood by a risk factor, by a weighting of where the road is most dangerous in the future.
It's Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest today is John DeNunzio, who's a transportation planner with SLOCOG, the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. We're talking about the Regional Road Safety Action Plan and the Slow Road to Zero. So SLOCOG got a federal grant, and you're spending it right now on gathering information. You've got this 25-year plan to reduce fatalities and serious injuries on our roads as much as possible between now and 25 years from now. So the gathering information part is about 5 years?
Yeah, that's a sensible amount given that roadways can change. A spot or an intersection 10 years ago might not look the same than right. It does now. So in the last 5 years, you'll kind of get a sense of the kind of the way that roads are now, mm-hmm. with the exception of maybe some road maintenance and things. Now to turn and to work with partners. So we need to work with the cities, the city public works departments, the county public works, Caltrans, to find the list of projects that are kind of already in the pipeline and then see where they match up against this high injury network that we're coming up with based on the safety trends, but also based off of the community storytelling and community identified locations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so once you've got a whole bunch of information, how do you then go about fixing that? And is that a part of this grant? Is the fixing it part of this grant and part of this project?
Yeah, so a reasonable plan is not going to be able to address everything, but we will make some priority decisions, and then we'll balance those decisions against what amount of money we think that we can reasonably expect to receive from the state and federal government in the next 5 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Although we'd be closing the surveys, I still think that I think we should keep it open forever. Mm-hmm. I think we should continue to keep a channel open so that we can hear about the unmet needs for safety well into the future. I think even though the work that we're doing is tied to a set plan and we have a set steering committee and a technical working committee that has met for this plan, safety is not going to go away as something that we need to do. And we're only just scratching the surface on hearing about the stories like Samantha Hermeland. You know, like we're only just now learning about, you know, what the human experience has been and where people might feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it makes sense because, as you said, roads change, people's habits change, the type of a car, or who knows if there's going to be some kind of personal transportation device that is new. And we'd be out there on some kind of fancy unicycle that,
you know,
there might be a hoverboard
yes.
in the future. So that makes sense to continue to gather information and study the roads and the potential hazards as they arise. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, John DiNunzio, for coming and talking with me. Is there anything that I missed that you might want to touch on before we wrap it up?
You know, thanks for asking that, because we did receive a continuation grant. So, and we did this not through the feds, but through the California Office of Traffic Safety, where we do something and started to do something called safety field walks. And so safety field walks are an opportunity for a few members of, say, a community area advisory committee, like a traffic and circulation committee, or if you're on a city council, maybe a public works advisory committee. But we're going to be going out to 9 or 10 of them in the unincorporated communities around the county. So with this grant, we're not going to be going to the cities, so City of Pismo or City of SLO, but we're going to be going out to the communities, the unincorporated communities, and performing a walk audit. Mm-hmm. And so with a few partners coming in 2025, and along with Cal Poly's civil engineering class on traffic safety, with a few community members, we'll be going kind of up and down a road and picking up safety issues like connectivity, curb ramps, ADA elements, et cetera. And kind of seeing for ourselves and documenting for ourselves and for our county unincorporated areas, where do they feel unsafe? Mm-hmm. So again, the World Day of Remembrance is November 17th at the SLO County Courthouse.
Okay. Well, again, thank you. I've been talking with John DiNunzio, transportation planner with SLO COG, the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, about their Regional Road Safety Action Plan and the Slow Road to Zero project to drastically reduce fatalities and serious injuries on our roads in San Luis Obispo County. My name is Marisa Waddell, and this is Issues and Ideas.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, we are going to talk about the Morro Bay Bird Festival, January 16th to the 20th, 2025. I have Bob and Robbie Revel here to talk about the Bird Festival. The reason we're talking today, last year, we were talking about the Bird Festival, and it was, maybe 2 weeks away. And I said, so what do you need to do this event or that event? He just shrugged and said, you need to have signed up in November. So this year, I was determined to talk to you before the first day of signups because things do sell out.
That is correct.
Yeah, so here we are. What's the history of the Morro Bay Bird Festival?
It started back in 1996. The local Chamber of Commerce and Morro Coast Audubon, plus a couple of other organizations, got together and decided to put on a bird festival. And the main reason was to help the economy in Morro Bay because it was a slow time with tourism back in those days. And secondly, they wanted to showcase the birds that came into Morro Bay. And so that's how it got developed. And 28 years later, here we are.
Have the goals changed at all? You have the same goals?
We basically do have the same goals, three basic goals. One is to celebrate the diversity of birds that are in Morro Bay and the county of San Luis Obispo at that time. We also want to showcase the beautiful area. We have people come from all over the United States, and this year we're actually expecting visitors to come over from Europe. And thirdly, we want to provide a financial boost to the local economy.
Yeah. You have so many events. And it starts on January 16th, runs through the 20th. That's like a Thursday through Monday. How many events do you have?
Well, 2 days ago, we had 258 events on the calendar. Now we have 259. We recently added one new event. Of those 259, 196 of those are what we call field trips. Mm-hmm. And these are opportunities for people to go with expert leaders to look at either birds or some other aspect of nature. We go as far north as the Elephant Seal Rookery above San Simeon. We go east out into the Carrizo Plain. We go south down to Oso Flaco Lake, which is south of Aurora Grande. And westward, we go at 20 to 30 miles offshore to look at birds out in the ocean. We have three trips we call pelagic trips that are on one of our large boats out of Morro Bay that go out into the ocean.
And I'll bet those are some of the ones that sell out early.
They sell out really, really quickly because, like I said, a lot of those birds are out there and you don't get a chance to see them because yeah. they never come ashore.
Yeah, what a treat. Yeah. The Santa Margarita Lake, Montaña de Oro, Fiscalini Ranch Preserve, Laguna Lake, Oso Flaco Lake, Kern National Wildlife Refuge. It says Exploring Otter Space.
Exploring Otter Space is a trip that I'm glad you brought that up because not all our trips are associated with birding. This is a particular trip that goes and looks at the sea otters that live in Morro Bay, and it's an explanation of what they're doing and what they need to survive.
I've seen them from kayaks. At a distance. We were always careful to keep our distance.
Right.
But they're fascinating to watch. And then California condors.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. The California condors. We've got, I believe, three different presentations on the California condor. For those that don't know, the California condor was near extinction back in the 1980s, primarily due to lead poisoning. They were eating animals that had been shot with lead shot and digesting that, and then the poisoning was setting in. They actually were all captured, and they did captive breeding, and now they are releasing them into the wild. We have three presentations in the classroom, but we have multiple trips that are going to go out and look for them. Normally, in the past, have gone up to the Big Sur area or down to Bitter Creek or over to the Pinnacles to look for them. But the Condor Project has been releasing condors up just north of Cambria, up in the mountains around San Simeon. And those condors, luckily for us, are staying in the area and roaming up and down San Simeon Creek Road.
Oh, wonderful.
So we're going to be looking for those.
This one cracks me up, I have to just say. Lazy birding 101. I feel like that's what we do in our backyard. We sit around, we watch the crows, you know. Oh, look, here they are.
What you would fit right in that class. Okay, so birders come in all sizes and shapes. Some are casual birders and some are diehard birders. They'll get a report through one of the posting services saying there's a rare bird 200 miles away, they'll jump in their car and drive at the speed limit, hopefully, to get there and look at it. This class is primarily for those who want to take it easy. The idea is you bring your favorite drink, coffee, whatever, and a chair, and you just sit and look at birds and talk about what you're seeing.
When I remember a snipe hunt, you know, it was a joke that some older kids did for some of us little ones camping. And I told my dad about it when we came home, and he laughed his head off.
Well, this one's not a laughing matter. It's a real thing.
But I mean, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, I've been on those. At least went once.
Yeah, once. After that, you know better.
Yeah, but that is down to Osofleco Lake. And we were actually looking for that particular bird that prank was named after.
Okay. It all sounds like fun. And it looks like you have, you know, events for people with different abilities. I see one where people are on a bike, a lot of walking ones.
Right, we do. Most of the field trips do involve walking, but we have biking trips. One is called a biking big day, which means they're out biking all day long and trying to see as many birds as possible. We have two kayak trips per day over 5 days.
So people can choose, you know, whether they want to walk or not, or
yes,
bike or...
Yes.
How do you get the kids involved?
Well, getting them involved doesn't necessarily take place at the bird festival. They're getting involved through other activities. For example, the local Audubon office in Morro Bay is putting on multiple field trips every month and encouraging young people to come on those. And Robbie could talk more about that with the education director there. But what we do is then we give them an opportunity to come to our festival and go with other young birders and leaders who are young people to go on trips as a group. And trust me, we have a lot of young birders, especially in this county. We keep track of things on eBird, which is a way that you can contribute. You can input in the birds that you see when you go out each day, and it builds up a huge database. We call it citizen science, that researchers can then look and see what birds are where. And some of the best of those e-birders are young people.
Oh, nice.
And they're actually inputting data.
Well, their eyesight is certainly good.
Yes. Young eyes and young legs.
And a smartphone.
Right.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas at KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman, and we are talking to Bob and Robbie Revel about the Morro Bay Bird Festival. Robbie Revel.
I am the executive director, which just means I am the chairperson of the festival. We have multiple committees that take care of various activities, and we have a vendor's bazaar that opens on Friday and runs through Sunday, and it is free to the public. And that bazaar is a gathering of artists that relate to wildlife, of course, as well as a place where nonprofits from the area that we also support can come and provide their information on their own nonprofit, like the Morro Coast Audubon Society, Pacific Wildlife Care, BLM Lighthouse, the Center for Biodiversity, Sea Otter Savvy, and the Beaver Brigade. So those are all there in our bazaar, as well as some of these vendors. We have beautiful wildlife art, as well as one of the main opportunities in the year for the public to come and see optics. Out of this World Optics is going to be there, Nikon, Kawa, Zeiss, and Opticron. They will have all of their binoculars and all of their scopes.
Nice.
And it's a way for people who can't get binoculars or scopes or cameras to come and see all of those different ones. Family Day, free. It's like a family fair. And we have live birds and critters. We have unique bird crafts, owl pellet dissection, which is fascinating for adults and young people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sketching and painting for young people. So that is on Saturday. We have the hot dog cart there. The high school will be selling cookies and things like that. So it's really a very involved and free day for our community.
January
18th. Correct.
It's nice to have some free events in there. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Bob and Robbie Revel about the Morro Bay Bird Festival.
To come to the festival, you register and you get a registration pass. We have 1 day passes and then we have a full pass, which covers all four and a half, or we call it 5 days. And if you have either one of those passes, you can go to the majority of the events for free. I think around 200 of our 250 events are free. The ones that have an additional charge associated with it are where we have to pay either a bus company to transport people, or we rent a boat, or we rent kayaks.
Okay, that makes sense. And as far as money goes, I'm assuming when I look at the extent of this festival that there's a pretty big financial impact for the whole community.
There is. Based on our last 2 years' history of financial expenses and stuff, we will probably spend this year around $225,000 mm-hmm. with the local community. We'll spend probably a total of $250,000, but $225,000 of that will go to local businesses to rent facilities, to have housing for our leaders, to purchase materials and stuff like that. Also, based on last year's survey of attendees, we found that our attendees contribute a lot of money also. This year, we're expecting 1,000 people to register. And based on past history, two-thirds of those people live outside the 934 zip code.
Oh, wow.
Now, what that means is they need a place to stay, and they need food to eat, and they need, in some cases, transportation. So we estimated this year that there will probably be another $625,000 that will flow into the community to provide those services. So that's a total of about $850,000.
Registration starts online November 2nd, 8 a.m. Pacific time.
Correct.
Now, you say that a lot of these things sell out.
We recommend that you register right away if you have specific things that you want to go on.
Yeah.
I'll just tell you, last year, when registration opened at 8 a.m. on Saturday, by noon, about half of our events were full.
By noon.
Last year, we had 200 events. This year, we are up to 259. And the reason we added more events is we've added more of the most popular events. And so the idea there is that there'll be more choices for people. You go to our website, marlbaybirdfestival.org. It's important to register on the first day, but you can always find things later on.
Let's say some of us who live here would like to volunteer. Do you need any more volunteers?
We definitely need volunteers. And there's an easy way to do that. You go to our website, marlbaybirdfestival.org. And there at the top, there's a thing to click on that says volunteer. And you fill out a simple little form, submit that, and our volunteer committee will be in touch right away.
Great.
We need volunteers, need lots of volunteers. And there's some benefits to volunteering too.
I think we'll be talking to you again as we get closer to the event, maybe early January, right after the first of the year, but we wanted to have you in now so our listeners can have an opportunity to sign up that first morning if they want to. So thank you both for coming in, Bob and Robbie, and we'll be talking to you again. This is the Morro Bay Bird Festival coming up January 16th to the 20th, 2025. Registration starts at 8 a.m. November 2nd. This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Playing with Food.
My name's Justin Warren. We're the owners of Shanley Farms here in Morro Bay. We are going to go down into a part of the orchard here where we grow a lot of specialties, including passion fruit, dragon fruit, and this is one of the first coffee plantations in the United States.
What? A Morro Bay coffee plantation?
My father-in-law, Jim Shanley, and Jay Reske put together this program where they started with the initial varietals and propagated thousands of plants in a nursery that we owned in Goleta.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. You heard correctly. Coffee is being grown on the Central Coast, and one of the first coffee plantations in California is cool, foggy Morro Bay. But coffee comes from Colombia, Brazil, and Indonesia. How could it grow on the Central Coast? We'll get to that answer a bit later, but first, let's follow Justin around his coffee plantation in Morro Bay.
Some of those varietals came here and got planted as one of the first coffee plantations. I think there's 3,500 plants in the Arabica family. We have 11 different varietals here. Paca, Pacamara, Coutura, the Geisha varietals, and a slew of other ones. These are planted underneath the avocado trees, so they'll get partial sun. If they get too much sun, they'll get burning on the leaves and the fruit.
They don't look anything like I thought they would look like.
With there being so many different varietals, they'll flower and fruit at different times. I think if we go down a few rows, we'll get into the Geisha varietals. They should be fruiting about now. And as you can see on this plant here, you'll see some red coffee cherries. The plants will flower at different times, so on one stem you'll have multiple pieces of fruit, but they're not ready to be picked all at the same time, so you have to go in and hand pick out the perfect color of fruit, sugar content. Really, it's very labor intensive, and you want to wait until you harvest. When this fruit's this dark burgundy color, you would pick it. Only pick a few of these at a time. That's why it's so labor intensive. You can actually eat this whole cherry.
Okay.
There's a tool called a refractometer that will measure the sugar content in these, and in farming they call it Brix. The Brix is the sugar content. We measured these the other day at 26, 28 Brix. So they're very sweet. If you eat quite a few of these, you'll actually get a caffeine buzz.
So should I try now?
Yeah.
Are you going to try one?
Sure.
Cheers. They're delicious. Mm-hmm. And they kind of taste like cherries. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, they're absolutely delicious. Mm-hmm. Why would you roast them and make them into like bitter coffee?
I don't know. To extrude the two green beans within this cherry. So there's a hulling process where you take off this cherry skin, a mucous membrane, which you have to process that out through fermentation. And then there's a parchment layer, which is a hard shell around these two beans. And then there's a drying period. So there's a whole process to this that we haven't purchased the equipment yet.
That is quite labor intensive. I had no idea. I didn't even know what a coffee plant looked like.
Most coffee consumers have no idea how the coffee's grown. They either buy it in their Folgers cup or they go to their local coffee shop or whatever. It comes black in a cup. Typically people see a roasted bean.
How did they figure this out? You know, who figured out, it's like, oh, there's some seeds in there. It's like, oh, well, let's clean them up. And like, right. Oh, well, let's dry them out. And then let's roast them.
Yeah.
Let's grind them and steep. It's like there's a lot of steps in there.
There's a few different ways of processing this. They call it a wash. To do it right, you would have the processing equipment and you'd pick these beans at the perfect time and all that. But we did a really crude way the other day. My kids harvested maybe a few pounds and they squeezed out the two beans. We let them dry for a few days on a cookie sheet out in the sun. And we put them in our air fryer to roast them and it worked.
Okay. How did it taste?
We put them in a grinder after that and did a pour over. It was amazing, but we had a great time doing it and I thought it tasted amazing. But I also had a cup of coffee from the liquor store down the street earlier. So I'm not like a huge coffee connoisseur. Some of this coffee, just like wine, goes through a scoring process, cupping contest for quality.
So are we gonna pick coffee?
Yeah.
Wow, this one is really on the inside, right in there, some really good ones. So that kind of indicates that they do want the shade because the ripe berries are underneath all of the canopy. They're not like right out in the sun.
Exactly.
Right up there. How many cups do you think this will make?
Probably one and a half.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's great. And I'm excited to try to make coffee. It's a very good start to make my own cup.
Justin and I picked about a quart of coffee cherries. I took them home and processed them by hand. I'll share the results with you later, but first let's visit California's coffee pioneer, Jay Ruskie, and the state's only coffee processing facility. Through my conversation with Jay, you will hear what I did right and what I didn't.
Jay Ruskie. I'm CEO and co-founder of Fringe Coffee. We help farmers grow coffee, we process it, and help them sell it here in California. My original farm is in Galea, California, Goodland Organics. That was the original coffee farm in California. And then we formed Fringe Coffee in 2017 because we had planted about a dozen coffee farms in Southern California. And I had industry people in both agriculture and the coffee industry want to do something more with California coffee. So we formed Fringe Coffee. And today there are well over 70 farms in California that are attempting to grow coffee.
We often think of coffee coming from places like Brazil and Colombia, and the climate here on the Central Coast isn't anywhere like that. So how is coffee growing here?
Coffee grows in over 32 regions in the world. So it's actually a pretty diverse climate conditions. And in fact, the nicest coffees in the world are in those tropical regions, but up high in the mountains where it's cooler. What they're trying to do with elevation, we're doing with latitude. And there's also a lot of coffee in southern Brazil, or also in the high latitudes in the southern hemisphere. So in California, we're here about 31.5 degrees north, but we're in a tropical belt. In Southern California, there are 300 or 400 different types of plants that grow here. And many of those come from the same regions of Brazil, and the coffee fits right in California. And they grow alongside with avocados and lemons, and they require similar environmental conditions and similar soil conditions. So we've just adapted.
And when did you first bring coffee?
In 2002, I worked with Dr. Mark Gaskell from the University of California Small Farm Extension Service. He brought me my first trees. Yes, it's been a several decade adventure, and it's only in the past 6 or 7 years we've really gone serious and looking at commercialization. And that's kind of run parallel with a market development for premium coffee globally. And that's what is really driving us. We're not just growing commodity-grade, world-traded coffee. We're actually doing premium coffee, growing some of the finest coffees in the world. And so this is not your standard gas station coffee. This is coffee that would be served in some of the nicest places around the world.
I'm here to learn about the processing. And one of the things I learned about processing is that Juan Valdez makes it look easier than it is, and it's pretty complicated. So where do we start?
Let's pretend you just brought me some coffee, and then we'll walk through the process.
Okay.
You know it's a coffee cherry, right? We can depulp it, which is a wash coffee, or we can go with on-cherry fermentation, which is also recognized as a natural coffee. You can have the same cultivar, but you can have like a more fruit-forward coffee with a natural process, or you can maybe bring out some more acidity in a wash coffee. But we have some wash coffee on the deck, so let's go walk out there and get our hands sticky and dirty.
Okay, cool.
Okay. So you just brought me coffee. The coffee will then come to this machine here. The skin is removed from the cherry, exposing the two seeds. Kicks out the skins on one side and brings the seeds here.
Okay, so I squeezed the seeds out of mine. That's what I did.
All right, well, that's basically what this is doing here.
Okay. I was surprised at how easy it was to squeeze them out.
It is for the first 100 cherries. And then right after that, each seed is covered in a piece of fruit. So a mucilage is the name of it. And it gets really difficult to dry because it's basically the fruit. Why don't you walk into the fermentation room and I have some fermentations for you. And you'll see these are coffees going through fermentation. You'll see the bubbling going on.
Yeah.
That's the CO2, and there's actually alcohol as a byproduct of the coffee. You can feel much of that mucilage is beginning to fall off. This probably needs another day. I turn them a couple times a day.
It looks like bean soup.
It looks like lima bean soup. You see it's still bubbly, so it's very active. The seeds, I rub them together. They have a lot more of a, like a sandpaper, so I know that sugar and the carbohydrates and the mucilage meat is done. This is where we're going to take them out in the sinks and we'll wash those sugars off, exposing a perfectly clean bean. There's before and after right there. What we have are these raised racks. This is what we'll place the depulped coffee on for probably about a week as they dry. We have to turn them, and the goal is again from this saturated wet state down to about 11% moisture content. You want to see our drying tunnel?
Okay, sure.
Let's go over here.
Wow.
This is our outdoor drying tunnels, and we have these plastic tunnels up above, and then we have fans blowing air through, and then we have 3 or 4 dozen racks here. What you see now is actually natural coffee, which is fermented on cherry coffee. We have to turn these every day. They look like raisins, right? The goal is that the coffee will actually be a fruit-forward coffee. There'll be complexity that you'll get in the cup that you can't get anywhere else in the world. But these will be out here for 3 weeks.
They're in the skins. So how do you get the skins off?
We have to mill them off. So it's part of this 20-step process to get you a cup of coffee from the farmer.
Juan Valdez just had, he had a donkey and he had bags of coffee and he brought it down from the mountains.
Yeah. The donkey is just a front man, just the mascot. We're near the ocean still. The humidity doesn't really get under 20% too often. And we need to get these coffees down to about 11 to 12%. And so this is the finishing room where we have dehumidifiers to bring the humidity down a little further. When they're stable, we put them in what we call Reposo curing lab. And I can take you to the Reposo room next.
Okay.
Okay, here we go.
feel like I've missed some steps in my coffee preparation.
So this is where they just hang out in repose.
Yes, it's chilled here, it's dark, and we just want them to kind of relax. And there's a lot of magic that happens in that. And so we still have one more process, which we call the dry mill process.
Okay.
So that's our next stop. Derek is actually pulling coffees and then running them through this mill. And this mill is removing the shell in the parchment and the husk in the cherry. And then that exposes the green bean, and then that allows us to begin to test coffee. So Derek is a Q grader, which is a certified coffee taster, right?
Coffee grader.
I've been around the coffee industry for a long time, and I wanted to professionalize, so I got a certification, went and did a course.
You're like the sommelier of coffee.
Similar, yeah. It's not necessarily consumer facing like a sommelier would be, it's more in the back end. And then we're milling it so that we can create samples so that we can roast those and then taste the coffees from there.
The only reason those aren't roasted is because I haven't had time. I was going to put them in a nonstick pan and stir very slowly until they turned dark brown. What would have happened?
Well, you would have over-roasted the outside, the parchment, and then there's a little air gap, thermal gap, in the green beans inside, so you would have under-roasted the green bean. So it would have been near disaster, but I do hear quite frequently this happens, and people still can roast and do all that, but it's essential to remove that outer shell. This is the magic moment for the coffees for us. You've seen this process. We've depulped it. It's been drying, it's curing, but we still haven't seen the green bean yet.
Right.
And so this is when we expose the first stage of quality of the coffee. And the next thing, if we want to taste it, we have to roast it. And then once we're done with roasting, we'll actually have to cup it.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, exploring California coffee. During the walkthrough of the processing of coffee, you heard that I, too, pulped to expose the bean, fermented to remove the fruit, and dried the coffee. It was only after my visit with Jay that I removed the husk, roasted, brewed, and tasted. During the roasting process, Justin's beans didn't get any darker after 10 minutes more of roasting. I didn't want to burn them, so I stopped. Jay's beans got darker faster, and they plumped up to twice their size, and they gave off a floral aroma that I carefully monitored because I didn't want to roast that aroma away. How did it turn out? I'm here with my two coffees. I've got Justin Shanley's coffee in one glass, and I've got Jay Ruskey's coffee in another glass. During the roasting, I was worried that I would burn the Shanley beans. They weren't getting any darker, so I stopped it, and when grinding it, it turned very, very blonde. I've heard of blonde coffee before, but I haven't had it before. And so it's not dark at all. It looks like whiskey. And then the Jay Ruskey coffee looks like darker whiskey. And you can see the pictures on the website. I'm going to try them now. Here goes the Shanley coffee. Ooh, that's nice. That is really nice. It's like coffee flavored water, but it's stronger than that. Here is the Jay Ruskey coffee. Oh, that's beautiful. I don't even know how to describe it. It's really, it's so smooth and so velvety. I don't know what to say. It actually has hints of whiskey in it. Wow. Both of them were really good. Different experiences of coffee. And maybe one day this week I'll make a full cup of coffee. Maybe I'll do espresso and see what it's like. But I will say, harvesting, processing, and making your own coffee is definitely not worth it. Just buy some really good coffee. Now let's go back to Derek and see how it should really be done.
So what do we have here?
We have a Lorina and we have a Geisha. We are about to cup both of them and taste them. So first I'm going to grind them, and then we're going to smell the dry fragrance. You just want to put your nose in the bowl.
Okay.
And just kind of take a big smell of it and kind of breathe out through your mouth as you do that. See?
Smells like coffee. This one smells more bitter, and that one smells kind of lighter and smoother.
I wouldn't say bitter necessarily, but to me, this one has more low tones, has a bit more of that what you associate with really nice classic coffee flavor. A little more nutty, maybe chocolatey, but then also has maybe some apple-like fruitiness to it. And then this one, which is the Geisha, typically we're looking for things that are a little bit more extravagant, so floral notes and tropical flavors as well. And that might be what you're responding to in regards to the lightness of the scents.
Is it like wine where if I'm not smelling what you're smelling, I'm not doing it right?
No. I think there's a subjectivity to it. But then, of course, when you're doing it professionally, I think that there is some degree of consensus. But I think whatever you're smelling is fine. Okay. If you're smelling coffee, that's cool.
That's good.
We're going to pour water on the grounds, and then we're going to smell it again. And we'll wait a little bit, and then we're actually going to taste the coffee with a spoon. So you see there's kind of a nice little crust on the top of the bowls here. We want to kind of smell that too, just the same way we did with the dry grounds.
With the water, the floral notes came out of the one that I said was bitter. On the one that was floral, the darker notes came out, I feel. Is there any reality to that?
Well, there might be for you. I mean, but I do think that definitely it opened up on the one that you're saying was bitter. But I think it just kind of gave me a little bit more of that, a little more caramel, that kind of thing. And then on this one over here on the geisha, if you smell again, really, you do get a little bit of the roast characteristic coming through. Not to say it's over roasted or anything like that. At the same time, I think you do also get some of that tropical fruit character that I was talking about as well.
Okay.
So what we're going to do now is a thing called breaking the crust. So we had that crust on the top. We're just going to break it. Just use the spoon and just stir the grounds. And what it does is it actually stops the extraction. So. And at the same time, it gives you a nice sense of what's going on with the coffee. It's a very intense moment.
So I'm smelling while I'm breaking the crust.
Yes, but just the tops.
It's really nice and soft.
The aroma? Yeah, for sure. So we're going to take this spoon. It's a special spoon for cupping coffee. We're going to take a small amount of coffee, and then we're going to just slurp it into the mouth. And then kind of breathe out through your nose, and you'll kind of get the sort of gist of what's going on with the coffee.
I have zero confidence in myself. Okay.
Yep.
What am I supposed to do now?
I would take the rest of it. And then now I would recommend that before you make a judgment on that, to just rinse your spoon, then try the next one, and just try them next to each other a few times to kind of see if you notice any differences.
Yeah, they're very different.
What are you tasting? It's a fairly complex coffee, so I think it's very floral. There's a tea-like component to it. There's a nice lemon finish to it. There's not a high quantity of the body, but it's a high quality of a body. There's a nice vanilla component as well, florality and kind of tropical juiciness.
Okay, what about this one?
Right off the bat, this one's giving me like a really nice mixture of vanilla, a little caramel, and a green apple note that comes out. The acidity really manifests itself as more of an apple-like acidity as opposed to like a lemon-like acidity. My job is just to taste the coffee and grade it, basically.
And when you grade it, what do you...
What do I grade these as? Yeah, let's see. It's going to go off the top of my head because, you know, I'm not doing it seriously. I'm going to say for La Reina, it's definitely in the 85 range. The geisha is definitely in the 87, 88. The scoring system basically for specialty coffee begins at 80. Anything between 80 and 90 is what a lot of the coffee that you're tasting at higher end coffee shops. But things that are above 84 are really quite nice. And then when you get very high on the scale towards the high 80s, like this geisha, for instance, you're really starting to taste very exceptional and very rare coffees. Very few coffees score in the 90 point range. It's a logarithmic scale. So the jump between 87 to 88 is huge. And some of the coffees that I've tasted have sold at auction for $10,000 a kilo and higher.
Who drinks that?
The buyers are mostly in East Asia, in China, Japan, Korea, but then also in the UAE. Hmm. It's pretty good. Once you're getting to that level, which is truly extremely unique coffees, you're looking at very haunting flavors.
Just also note that, you know, if you're trying dark coffees, because usually they're hiding something, lean towards trying the lighter coffees because they're not carbonizing the sugars.
I think my cupping skills were a bit disappointing to Derek and Jay, but what an amazing process to get from bean to cup. Coffee is very labor-intensive, but I learned that there is a better coffee out there than what I've been drinking. Perhaps you can't afford $10,000 a kilogram for your coffee. I get that. But if you happen to see California coffee around, give it a try, because Jay gave us words to live by.
I think as we become more self-aware and become conscious of the foods that we need to eat and how they affect us, something like coffee that you may do every day that actually has a pretty big impact on your day. If you love yourself, treat yourself to a better cup of coffee.
Go out and love yourself and treat yourself. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday
from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.